From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Hungarian writer George Conrad. Under communism, his books were banned. Now he's helping to protect the freedom of other writers as president of PEN, the International Writers Organization. Later, we meet British actress Emma Thompson. She was the woman with amnesia and a past life in Dead Again, and the Duchess in Impromptu. Now she's starring in Howard's End, the new film based on the E.M. Forster novel. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Player, Robert Altman's new movie about Hollywood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. After 5 days of deliberations, the jury in the drug trafficking trial of former Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega has reached a verdict of guilty on 8 of the 10 counts he faced. Melissa Mancini reports from Miami.
A guilty verdict was rendered on the key racketeering and conspiracy counts that charged Noriega helped at least 15 others manufacture and ship cocaine to the United States. The government accused Noriega of signing on with Colombia's Medellin cartel in the early 1980s and protecting its growing cocaine trafficking network. However, jurors acquitted the former military leader of 2 counts. Noriega was found not guilty of smuggling cocaine aboard a luxury yacht in 1986. Noriega faces up to 120 years in prison. His sentencing is scheduled for July 10th. The general also faces a 2-count marijuana smuggling indictment in Tampa. It's not clear when or if that trial will take place. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
Federal investigators told Congress today that money intended for the cleanup of toxic waste has been spent on parties, limousine services, and club memberships. Representative Mike Sinar said that the government may be reimbursing hazardous waste contractors for millions of dollars in questionable expenses. EPA Inspector General John Martin said that although many of those expenses appear unreasonable, most are not improper under federal regulations. Martin called on Congress to enact legislation that would allow the EPA to clearly identify improper spending by its contractors. Congressional investigators found that contractors working on Superfund cleanup projects had submitted expenses that included season baseball tickets, air travel, and limousine service. The federal government has spent more than $6 billion on the Superfund program over the past decade. The Russian and Ukrainian presidents today took steps to defuse the conflict over the Black Sea Fleet. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
According to the Russian news agency, both Russian President Boris Yeltsin and Ukrainian President Leonid Kravchuk have rescinded decrees in which each claimed jurisdiction over the Black Sea Fleet. Their decision to call a truce in this duel of decrees came after the two leaders spoke twice by telephone today. They have also agreed to set up a commission to negotiate a division of the fleet, which is based on the Crimean Peninsula and comprises some 600 warships and aircraft and 70,000 sailors and soldiers. Earlier this week, each president had issued an order claiming formal control of the fleet. That sparked demonstrations in Sevastopol, the headquarters of the fleet, and a fear in both Moscow and Kiev that the struggle over the fleet would come to violence. For now, at least, a further escalation of the conflict has been avoided. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 44 points to close at 3,225. Advances led declines by 13-4 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Bush said today that he's very much concerned by a reported upsurge of military activity in Iraq, including 4 straight days of practice runs by Iraqi combat jets. Pentagon spokesman Bob Hall said that Iraqi anti-aircraft radars are still tracking Allied planes despite U.S. objections. Hall said that the commanding general of the Allied task force assigned to protect Kurds in northern Iraq has conveyed U.S. objections to Iraqi military leaders. Palestine Liberation Organization leader Yasser Arafat has left a hospital in Libya where he was treated for injuries he suffered in the forced landing of an airplane. The BBC's Jane Rowland reports from Tunis, the home base of the PLO.
Initial reports about his condition said he had escaped his ordeal virtually unhurt. But pictures of the PLO leader on Libyan television last night suggested his condition might be more serious. Wearing a bandage over one eye and with a large bruise on his face, Mr. Arafat was lying in a hospital bed. but the Libyan health minister was quoted as saying that Mr. Arafat had no fractures or serious injuries. Mr. Arafat was due back in Tunis today to chair a meeting of the PLO's Central Council. He gave his permission for the meeting to open without him, but now it has adjourned until his return. Some PLO officials have indicated that Mr. Arafat's stay in Libya could be extended. The head of the PLO's political department, Mr. Farouk Kadoumi, said Mr. Arafat needed 2 or 3 days to recover.
American Airlines announced today that it will simplify its airfare structure, dropping prices on first-class and coach tickets and eliminating many discounts and special fares. The company said the plan would result in first-class fares that are as much as 50% lower, with cuts of at least 38% in unrestricted coach fares. American Chairman Robert Crandall said the company was responding in part to consumer anger at the industry's complex system for setting fares. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During many of the years that Hungary was under communist rule, George Conrad's books were banned. But Hungarians still read his work in underground editions. Conrad is one of Hungary's leading novelists and intellectuals. Now that his books are back in bookstores and he's free to write what he wants, Conrad is defending the freedoms of other writers. He's the president of International PEN, the writers' organization which supports free speech around the world. Conrad's latest novel, A Feast in the Garden, has just been published in the States. The narrator of the book is a writer who tells about his childhood in Hungary as a Jewish boy during the Nazi occupation. His parents were arrested at the beginning of the occupation. The young boy managed to flee the village. This is also George Conrad's story. He told me about his parents' arrest and how he managed to escape his village at the age of 11.
They were arrested because the Gestapo arrested in the Jewish community of this so small town where there were the population was 12,000 and the Jews were maybe 1,000. And around 10 people were arrested, maybe because my father was more well-to-do. And he was accused that he's an English spy. Right? He was not. And then we children, my sister was 14, I was 11. We remained alone and also two cousins of mine. And some relatives from Budapest invited us, but it was not so easy to travel that time for Jews. It was not at all easy, so it was forbidden. And then I tried to get a permission. I corrupted, actually, the authorities through a lawyer, and I gave all the money my father had for this permission to leave the village.
You bribed somebody?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, all the authorities. And then we could leave the village one day before the deportation of these people, first in a neighboring bigger town, in the ghetto of this town, and later on to Auschwitz. So in Budapest, I felt, and we felt, that it's easier to disappear or to bring away the Budapest Jews will be maybe the last action of these authorities. And it came so out that Budapest Jews' deportation was hindered in the last moment. Mainly, I guess, by a very strong message of President Roosevelt through many neutral channels, for example, Sweden, that if the Hungarian authorities hope some special ceasefire or peace negotiations with the alliance, then they should stop the deportations. And they stopped the deportation of the Budapest Jews, therefore the community, the Jewish community of Budapest, which was also in 50% killed, but the other 50% survived, and therefore still in Budapest is the third biggest Jewish community in Europe, around 100,000 people.
In your new novel, Your narrator says, in the winter of 1944 to 45, I thought of death almost the way one thinks of firewood. There was nothing special about it. It was a thing beyond my control, and there was no point in fearing it. Does that describe your feelings about death?
Yes.
And did that change later? Like after the war, did death become more spiritual?
Yes, after the war, I didn't feel a mortal danger. I didn't forget, of course, completely the dangers, because, you know, in a country where the decisions were partly local and partly coming from outside, from Moscow, it was always the possibility open for a switch in the regime to a tougher line. And somehow people lived with the chance that maybe the next morning they will be brought away.
Did your parents survive the war?
Yes, it was a great chance, and they were very lucky. It's not only lucky, my mother was very tough, because once they were in Vienna, they had to work there with the ruins to somehow to clean the streets, and then they were led westwards to Mauthausen. And, you know, Mauthausen was an annihilation camp. And they knew something about it, and they walked on the road, and they went through a forest, and then my mother somehow organized a group of people who ran into the wood and disappeared. They could survive in this forest most dangerous days.
So you were reunited with your family after
that? Yes, they were the only couple who came back, who survived this year. And we were the only family which could maintain his integrity. We were the only children who came back alive. And when in 45, in February, just some weeks after the liberation, yes, for me it was a liberation.
Let me quote your character again. He says, my sister and I were the only two Jewish children in town. The 100 or so Jewish men who had lost their wives and children were nice to us, were glad we were alive, but I couldn't help feeling that our presence was a constant reminder to them of their misfortune. Did you feel that as a child?
Yes, sure, sure. If a man, strong adult man, look at you, cheer you, caress you, and then they start to cry, you can feel that they don't cry from the joy that they see you, but because they think on their own children who are killed.
In 1956 in Hungary, there was a popular uprising against the communist rule. There was a short period of liberalization, and then the Soviets cracked down and the leadership was replaced. Your character says, in 1944, a machine gun was pointed at me. In 1956, I slung one over my shoulder, preferring to be shot in an exchange of fire than by a firing squad. Did you carry a machine gun while participating in the 1956 uprising?
Yes, I got one. I was in the university, and it was organized a kind of national guard from the university student. I finished just the university, but somehow it was my home still. And then I had some minor activities with this machine gun. I was bodyguards of some professors who were active in the politics, and I accompanied them, and then I guarded different the port of the university, where there were very different committees of the revolutionary intellectuals. So I was a small man in that, and we had also some on the street some task to keep the order. And I went also with this machine gun and to do my literary activities, because I was a collaborator of a literary review which was founded just 2 months before the revolution, and it was a kind of very reformist, reform-minded review. And I made negotiations of the printing house director and with many people, and they were very, very kind, very nice, and they promised everything, and I was very happy because we young writers wanted to take over this review. And later on I heard that they was even frightened because I had my machine gun and I hanged it on as like an umbrella.
Mm-hmm. So did you ever fire this machine gun?
No, I never shot it with it. And I even never had the feeling that I have to shoot now this or this person. And I had also quite ugly experiences that, for instance, I go back, I go home with this machine gun, and there are in front of many houses ladies, maybe the wife of the landlord or such kind of ladies, who say, please come, and there is here a tenant on the third floor. Maybe you could kill him.
Great, yeah.
Yes, once I even saved a person who was accused that he's a member of the political police, and he should be killed. And there were some people who were lynched. And I went for him, and I let him out of this house because I said that it's quite dangerous for him. He was, by the way, a musician, and he was in the orchestra, of the copper orchestra of this political police.
Listen, I'm wondering, when people said, now that you have a machine gun, I have a tenant who, you know, maybe you could murder him. Did they offer you money?
Oh, no. It was from... They expected it from enthusiasm.
Wow. So what would you say to them? I mean...
I said, I don't do that, and please don't ask people to do that, but I'm not sure that I was convincing enough.
It must have been difficult to continue your relationship with them after that.
Yes, and afterwards I had also a kind of temptation when the Russian made their intervention. It was the 4th of November, and many, many tanks came, and the whole town was full of tanks. And then I went to the university to defend it. And we were there. We had many guns, submachine guns. But they didn't attack the university. And then we had, of course, many discussions what to do. And I had the crazy idea that not to fight the Russians because they are too powerful. They are too powerful, maybe, to make attempts against the collaborator. And then I went out with a revolver and I looked around for these people. And I realized that I cannot shoot anybody of them. I went back, I told it, I gave back the weapon. And since that time, I believe that I cannot or don't want to shoot anybody.
So you learned going after somebody that you were really incapable,
yes,
of using the gun. My guest is George Conrad. He's a writer from Hungary, and he's the first president of PEN International, the writers' organization. He has a new novel called A Feast in the Garden. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Hungarian writer George Conrad is my guest. In 1974, you were arrested with a writer who you had co-authored a book with on the role of intellectuals in Eastern Europe, and the book was banned. And I think you were told to leave the country. You were told you could leave the country if you wanted to.
Sure.
But you decided to stay. Why did you want to stay?
I am maybe a little bit conservative. I don't want so much to change my body context. And I was even writing a novel, The Loser. And it seemed to me more evident to write also the next day a new page and not to give myself to an adventure of changing my whole life, friendships, language, job. And somehow I felt also that with the whole family, children, mother, to transplant them all for my intellectual freedom is not so easy. And then it was also a difference with my friend. I approved completely his emigration. A scholar cannot, and I had many other friends who have chosen the emigration, mostly academic people. They need the university context. They need also the possibilities of research, of meetings, international meetings. But what needs really a novelist? Paper and pen.
Did you keep track of your friend after he emigrated? And I wonder if you ever envied him the decision.
We are still the best friends. Mm-hmm. And he's often in Hungary. He spends there some months. And we plan or we dream to write again a common book on the new situation of these countries and of intellectuals in the new society.
So did you ever have second thoughts about staying in Hungary?
No, my idea was that a writer or every people have to have the right to go and look around, but somehow I am maybe a little bit difficult person. I don't like to be very grateful because I can be there where I am. And in Hungary, yes, I was born there, so I don't own with any gratitude that I can live in my house. Abroad, I felt that I have to become also an academic person, but although I am interested reading books of human sciences, but I am not really an academic person.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you run into people who had been censors or police or bureaucrats who had harassed you for some reason under communist rule, if you run into them now?
There are some whom I meet.
And what's that experience like?
These are people who lost their internal force, or they are very uncertain. And I don't feel any vengeance.
Do you talk with them, or do you both
yes.
look in the opposite direction when you pass
no,
on the
no,
street?
No, I talk to them. Even I, it was a person who was the leading figure in the Politburo, who was somehow the dictator of the culture and who made many unpleasant actions against me. And when he was very sick from the cancer, I visited him in the last days of his life.
What made you do that? What prompted you to visit him?
I had a certain pity for him.
Pity because he was no longer in power, pity because he was so uncomprehending about what culture was really about?
He was not a stupid man, and He had his own morality, and he asked always, what did I wrong?
He didn't get it. He didn't understand.
He didn't understand. He understood many things. He didn't understand many other things. He justified himself. He tortured himself, I would say. And many people did that. There are many this type of people who are now in the mental asylums, who have nervous breakdowns, who lost the sense of their life, who call on phone the so-called telephone psychiatrists and tell that they have suicide ideas. And not only these type of people, also those who were not in high functions or who were not in the service of these police or political police, feel that somehow those values, what they had in a very status society, disappeared and they have to start something new, but they are too old to that.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a book back in 1974 on the role of the intellectual, and I wonder if you feel that your role as a writer and intellectual has changed in the past couple of years.
Sure, because I'm not a phantom, but I'm a public person. I can express myself, and there are some people who are interested, so the communication of myself with my readers is undisturbed. It gives also a kind of responsibility, because somehow I wanted this change. And when people are not so happy with this change, then it's not an easy feeling for me. And I feel also that I have some responsibility that things should go in the right direction, but there are many temptations, many internal conflicts. It's a very, very difficult learning process, and the price people have to pay for their real freedom with a kind of stability of their life will be very high.
One more question. You said that now that you're no longer a phantom, you can speak out and write anything.
What does it mean? That,
well, I'm wondering if you felt like a phantom beyond your writing. I mean, as a writer, you were a phantom.
Many people knew my name from the Radio Free Europe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They knew some of my papers or text in Samizdat. But now, as I am sometimes on the screen, they recognize me and they talk to me, and I am a real person.
Right. Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And my guest has been George Conrad. He's a Hungarian writer. His new novel, A Feast in the Garden, has just been published in the States by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. And Conrad is also the president of PEN International, the writers' organization. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet British actress Emma Thompson. She stars in the new film Howard's End, based on the E.M. Forster novel. She recently starred in Dead Again as a woman with amnesia. But as we'll hear, Thompson got her start in comedy. And Stephen Schiff reviews a new film about Hollywood deal-making called The Player, directed by Robert Altman. Tim Robbins stars, and just about everyone in Hollywood seems to make a cameo appearance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. After a trial lasting 7 months, Manuel Noriega has been convicted by a jury in Miami on 8 of 10 drug and racketeering charges against him. The former Panamanian leader's conviction included the key counts of racketeering and racketeering conspiracy. The 8 counts carry a possible sentence of 120 years. Sentencing has been set for July 10th. The defense says it will appeal. In Washington, President Bush said that the guilty verdict for Noriega will send a message. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president, speaking during a picture-taking session with Nicaraguan President Violeta Chamorro, said the guilty verdict was a major victory against the drug lords.
And I hope it sends a lesson to drug lords here and around the world. That they'll pay a price if they continue to poison the lives of our kids in this country or anywhere else.
The president said he thought the case against Noriega was solid and therefore he was not surprised by the verdict. Mr. Bush said he thought the U.S. invasion of Panama was worth it to bring Noriega to justice. The guilty verdict comes as a relief to administration officials who were worried at the prospect Noriega might be acquitted, and it gives the president a political issue for the fall. Now he can say that thanks to his administration, the war against drugs is being won. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
In Britain, votes are being counted in a general election that exit polls say is too close to call. Projections are that both the Conservative Party and the opposition Labour Party will fall short of the 326 votes needed to form a majority in the House of Commons. If that occurs, both parties will most likely try to form a government based on the support of smaller parties. Conservatives have been hurt by a continuing recession and high unemployment. A federal grand jury in Washington has filed new charges against a former employee of the House of Representatives Post Office. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The new indictment expands the grand jury's investigation of the post office from a probe focusing on embezzlement to a broader drug conspiracy. Today, a former stamp clerk at the postal facility, who had already been indicted for embezzlement, was indicted for selling crack cocaine to fellow workers. If convicted, the former employee, Wendell Magruder, could face up to 36 years in prison and $500,000 in fines. 3 former House post office employees have already pleaded guilty to charges of embezzling money and stamps. The House postmaster was forced to resign because of the drug and embezzlement scandal. The post office, along with many other services and facilities in the House, is under review by lawmakers. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 43 points to close at 3,224.96 on volume of 231 million shares. This is NPR News. Paul Tsongas has announced that he will not get back into the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. The former Massachusetts senator had suspended his campaign last month, but then Sunday said that he was considering a return to active campaigning. After wins by Bill Clinton in 4 primaries this week, Tsongas said his only role now would be that of a spoiler. He called on those taking part in a draft Tsongas campaign to end their efforts in his behalf. However, he also said that he would not discourage voters in the upcoming primaries from still voting for him. Secretary of State James Baker today challenged Congress to approve an aid package for Russia before President Boris Yeltsin visits Washington in June. The U.S. and 6 other large industrialized nations recently pledged to support a $24 billion economic aid package to Russia. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Secretary of State James Baker told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that economic support to Russia is Washington's most pressing national security imperative. Baker was trying to drum up congressional support for the Bush administration's pledge to contribute about $4.5 billion to a $24 billion economic package for Russia. If approved, the plan would guarantee loans by U.S. businesses launching ventures in Russia and underwrite loans for the Russian purchase of U.S. grain. It would also provide a new lending authority to the International Monetary Fund, which would then make loans to Russia. Many senators expressed their support for the package, but even supporters said approval of the plan could be difficult during an election year, with the United States facing economic problems of its own. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Even though consumers are still hesitant about spending, the nation's retailers say that sales were up a bit in March. Analysts pointed out, though, that Easter arrives late in April this year, so stores were not helped by apparel buying. Once again, Walmart had the largest increase. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The producer and director who adapted E.M. Forster's novel Room with a View have made a new movie based on Forster's 1910 novel Howard's End. My guest Emma Thompson stars with Anthony Hopkins, Vanessa Redgrave, and Helena Bonham Carter. Emma Thompson is best known in America for her double role in Dead Again as an amnesiac and a concert pianist. Her co-star was her husband Kenneth Branagh, who also directed the film. They've worked together many times in Branagh's Renaissance Theatre Company, as well as in his film adaptation of Henry V. In England, Thompson is also well known for her TV comedy series, which ran recently on some American public television stations. She got her start in comedy when she was a student at Cambridge performing in the Footlights Review, which also spawned Monty Python's Flying Circus. Thompson was also a member of Cambridge's first women's review.
Well, it wasn't a women's, there's a group as such. It was literally four women who got together and said, well, let's do an all-female review, which was called Woman's Hour, which is the name of a radio programme in England, which is very popular. It's on every day and discusses everything, you know, every topic under the sun. And it wasn't agitprop as such. You know, it wasn't a feminist review. It was just the first all-female review ever to have been staged in Cambridge, and we wrote it and directed it and put it all together, all of us together. And it went very well. It was a wonderful experience. Very interesting, because it's such a male bastion.
Well, you know, all the universities with male theatre groups do a lot of drag in the comedy and probably in the other theatre as well. So did you do drag in yours and dress as men and be men?
No. We, oddly enough, we found it perfectly possible to do a whole review without doing that.
Without any men at all.
Astonishingly. I think that kind of started something because... since there's been a lot more women coming up through the comedy ranks, if you like. I think you've always had the edge on us in America with comedy and female participation in that side of things. And you have a lot of female stand-ups, brilliant female stand-ups. And over the water, we're not so hot, really. There's a few really brilliant people, female people, in the comedy area, but it's still very, very much male-dominated, which is, what I suppose, one of the reasons why we did it. And then I carried on writing bits and bobs within the review groups that I was working, and then wrote a review series of my own for television, which was a very interesting experience.
Could you give us a sense of one of the sketches that you did that you thought was...
A good one,
yeah.
My favourite sketch is about a woman who's in an art gallery and she's looking at all these pictures. It's one of those art galleries where there's, you know, there's wine and cheese going on. And she's terribly nice. She's called Marjorie. And you see her standing there for quite some time looking at somebody much smaller than her, who she approaches after a while and says, you know, hello, and this is lovely, isn't it? And it's warm for once, you don't often get balmy nights in England. It's lovely, isn't it? She's just a little bit uncertain of herself, you know, and she's looking at all these pictures and saying, they're lovely, aren't they? Sort of blue and things. And then she looks at this person, she says, I'm terribly sorry, I don't know your name. Ho Piet Min. Ho? Oh, you're Vietnamese. Oh, how lovely. Hello, I'm Marjorie. And then she pauses for a while. She says, are you a boat person? Oh, how marvellous. How exciting. I've never met her yet. How was the journey? And so it goes on. And she discovers through the course of one of those awful middle-class conversations where somebody is desperately trying to empathise with a person who's had such terrible experiences that it's simply not possible to make those connections. And also, of course, deeply patronising. I mean, it was inspired by Lenny Bruce's How to Relax Your Coloured Friends at Parties. And then she discovers at the end that he is, in fact, the artist. And she discovers that all this time she's been talking to a person in that way that you do, and you do find yourself doing it sometimes, terribly patronising, kind of, you're not a real human being, are you? You're not the same as me. You have no status here. And she suddenly realises that she's standing in the middle of all his work.
My guest is actress Emma Thompson. She stars in the new film Howard's End, and she starred in the recent film Dead Again. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Actress Emma Thompson is my guest. We've been talking about class during this interview, the class of your characters and how their class enters into how they see themselves and how they behave with other people. Where do you fit in socioeconomically in England?
I am obviously, I'm middle class, but from a slightly unusual background. My father was working class British English home counties boy who had a, you know, a country accent and came from round Horsham, which is little villages about, say, 2 hours away from London, and went to drama school. He was born to my grandmother, who had a very interesting history. She was born in 1900 and went into service when she was 12 as a tweeny, i.e. an under housemaid, and she worked as a housemaid in lots of different places. And then when she was about 16 or 17, she went to work for this childless couple who, this was just during the beginning of the First World War, and the wife was very frightened of the Zeppelins that used to come over, and she used to go and stay with her mother in Brighton. And while she was away, the husband would exercise his droit du seigneur and have his way with my grandmother, who didn't really know what was going on, having not had any kind of education and being entirely in the hands of this rather unscrupulous employer. And she became pregnant by him, and the couple offered to take the child, and she said no, and was taken in by her family, who were extremely understanding about it. And they discovered that this couple had tried the same thing with several other maids, who had all said no and taken their children. And I think it was a sort of form of early surrogate motherhood, you know. They couldn't have children, and so this was the method by which they'd chosen to try and, as it were, adopt one. And my mother was born into a Scottish Presbyterian background, very peculiar. She had five, her mother and four very strange aunts who tended to die in odd places, like on Glasgow Central Station and in the linen department of Harrods. And they were a very eccentric family, Scottish, deeply Scottish, very large women with red hair, called things like Urelda and May and Ella. So a colourful background. And her grandfather was a vicar, you know, a rector in a Scottish church. So my grandmother was the daughter of a churchman, and she married a journalist. But both my parents came from broken homes, which was interesting. Both their parents' marriages split up.
Pretty colourful background.
It's a colourful and interesting background, and it's kind of difficult to put it into particularly class-conscious context, because both my parents did this strange thing of going to drama school, which in those days was not quite as glamorous as it is now. And both of them used to bemoan the fact that acting had become so terribly respectable. They didn't think that was a very good idea at all. They liked the roving, slightly untrustworthy nature that had been kind of attached, associated with actors before that. And I tend to agree with them. I think actors are accorded far too much importance. So by default, we are middle class, solidly middle class. And because they were both in the theatre, my background was extremely tolerant and interesting and surrounded by actors who never patronised children. They never talked down to you. I can remember Kenneth Williams telling me not to get drunk on champagne when I was, because it would give me the worst hangover, when I was very young, about 9. And it was wonderful from that point of view. I can remember very clearly discovering at about the age of 19 that, for instance, homosexuality was not widely accepted and being terribly shocked.
Sounds like your parents were almost bohemian.
Yes, I suppose it was a very liberal, free-thinking, but not bohemian intellectual, like, for instance, the Wolfs, not Bloomsbury, right. Not nearly as aristocratic as that, or patrician, very much more down-to-earth, I'd say.
Can I ask you how you met Kenneth Branagh, the actor who is also your husband?
Sure. We were doing The Fortunes of War, which was a long 9-month shoot based on the Balkan trilogy by Olivia Manning, which was is a great big long book about a couple, a young couple recently married, who make a journey to Romania at the beginning of the Second World War and become caught up in the movements of, you know, the Axis troops were moving towards Britain. So, of course, they keep on having to move further west to escape. And it's the portrait of a marriage of an extremely, not an unhappy, necessarily unhappy marriage, but a less than perfect marriage. And fascinating to play. One of those things where, you know, it's 7 hours television, so it's very much a detailed examination of a relationship. And so that's when. So there's plenty of time for us to get to know each other.
Did you try to keep your relationship a secret from the people you were working with, afraid that it would kind of intrude on either their perceptions of you or on your performances?
Not really, because it didn't become that kind of relationship. It didn't become an established relationship while that was going on. It wasn't like that. It was much more, you know, the mating dance. You
right.
Know what I mean, you know, a couple of birds bouncing up and down, you know.
You've worked together a lot.
Mm.
Some couples really don't like to work together and find that they need to really separate the marriage or the relationship from the work. Mm. What works for it with you?
I don't know. I just think we're very lucky, and I don't know whether it'll last. I mean, heaven knows when we come to do the next thing together, it might not work, and if so, we'll have to say, okay, well, time to have a bit of time apart. And we certainly don't plan necessarily to work together, although we like to keep the work in parallel, you know. So, for instance, when Ken is doing theatre, I will try and do theatre as well so that we're both at home at the same time. And try not to do, for instance, a 3-month movie somewhere else. So I'm not going to see him for 3 months because we really don't enjoy that at all. Although I do, I think that it's good to go from one thing to the other. I work together and then separate and then work together again. Don't do it continuously. And indeed, we don't. It may seem like it, but we don't.
I want to skip ahead to the movie Dead Again, which I know a lot of our listeners saw. And the movie was, just a couple of questions about this, the movie was set in 2 different periods. What was it like to see yourself as the 1940s version of yourself shot in the style of Hollywood glamour of the period?
Oh, it was the biggest thrill you can imagine. just the biggest thrill, because if it hadn't been for Ken, obviously, and Paramount having the good faith and indeed sort of taking their chance on me, on casting me, because they didn't really know anything about me, I would never have had that experience doing a very American kind of movie in Hollywood at Paramount Studios, being allowed to drive in through those gates and actually allowed to work there. It was absolutely fantastic. And it was wonderful going back to that era in American history, but particularly in Los Angeles in history of the 1940s. In fact, just after the war, when everybody was so happy, so it was, you know, the war was over and parties were everywhere, and glamour really did exist then, because the movie system had created stars, and the whole notion of stars and how stars lived and how they behaved and walk downs and glamorous balls and a kind of glamour that's completely gone now. And somehow it's all taken too seriously now. You know, I don't think there's nearly enough dressing up. I think it's all disappeared in some odd way. And stars are going more underground now.
Actress Emma Thompson, she stars in the new film, Howard's End. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what are you going to have on the Noriega verdict?
Hi, Terry. Manuel Noriega was convicted today, 8 of 10 drug and racketeering charges. We'll have a report from Miami, and we'll discuss the ramifications. Also, we'll talk with a former member of the Drug Enforcement Administration about his experience trying to stop cocaine production in Peru. He says both the Shining Path guerrillas and the Peruvian army are involved in the drug trade there. We'll have letters from listeners, especially about zoo manure, and the history of the Alcan Highway, completed 50 years ago this year, built from Dawson Creek up through the Yukon to Alaska.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. After years of rebellion and exile and failure, director Robert Altman seems to have made a Hollywood comeback. His new movie, The Player, is the talk of Tinseltown, not just because it's a satire about life at a studio, but because it features cameo appearances by more than 60 movie stars, including Cher, Bruce Willis, Nick Nolte, and Julia Roberts. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see what's behind the buzz.
A lot, actually. I think The Player is a masterpiece. The first one Altman has come up with since Nashville, way back in 1975. Even though The Player was adapted from a well-regarded novel by Michael Tolkien, who's credited with the screenplay, the movie is pure Altman. Wonderfully atmospheric, skillful without being show-offy, opulent and light-headed at the same time. The plot revolves around a production executive named Griffin Mill, played by Tim Robbins. He's a guy whose job is mainly to tell screenwriters no all day. One of the writers has apparently gotten fed up. He's sending Griffin death threats, and Griffin is getting worried enough to want to do something about it. The plot works, but the plot isn't the point. The point is what life in Hollywood looks and feels and sounds like, and Altman's got it down better than anyone since Billy Wilder in Sunset Boulevard. Take, for instance, this exchange, in which Griffin has just been pitched a story by a writer who wants to make sure his film is cast without stars. It's too beautiful, too honest a work for stars. Griffin thinks the movie's going to be a flop, but he wants to get the studio's latest hireling, a hot young executive named Larry, interested. That way Larry will sink when the film does. In this scene, Larry, played by Peter Gallagher, is the one on the car phone. Here's Griffin's pitch.
Let me give you a little tip, Larry. Levison came to power on 2 movies and made $300 million and had no stars in them. He's going to love this idea. It'll remind him of his youth. You know what his motto used to be? No stars, just talent.
Has anyone else heard this?
I don't think so, no.
We should make a deal now.
Tomorrow may be too late. Can we get a hold of Levison?
Yeah, I'll get Levison. When can you be back?
I'll be there right after my AA meeting.
Oh, Larry, I didn't realize you had a drinking problem.
Well, I don't really, but that's where all the deals are being made these days. See ya.
The studio hotshots are laughable monsters, of course, but Altman knows that the so-called scathing satire is the easy part. What he really wants to reveal is the psychology beneath the familiar Hollywood hypocrisies. If we expect the usual us-versus-them scenario, with brilliant creatives getting the spunk stomped out of them by Armani-clad Philistines, well, Altman's view is a lot subtler than that, and truer. The Player is about how the industry crushes the originality out of anyone who participates in it, any player, whether a writer, director, or a production chief. And that's because the movie-making process itself makes it impossible to view the world in a fresh or inspiring way. Enter the game and you can't help it. Everything, from the morning headlines to the person you love, gets ground to movie fodder. Altman uses screens within screens and movies within movies and some of the most amazing shots in memory to convey the idea that his characters wouldn't know the truth if it whacked them over the head, unless it whacked them in widescreen and Dolby with a tub of popcorn on the side. The Player has its grim aspects. Altman doesn't let anyone off the hook, least of all the audience. Even that amazing gaggle of movie stars is on hand for a reason. They're playing themselves, in restaurants and at parties, because in Hollywood that's where you really find them. Altman wants to convey the strangely distorted flavor of a world where everywhere you look you see the people the rest of America is busy dreaming about. If you swim among the stars, he's telling us, life outside the fish tank can start to look remote and unreal, just like a movie.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. We'd love to hear your comments about Fresh Air. Call us on our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin, research assistants from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the challenges of shooting on location in Thailand, Colombia, and India. We talk with Roland Jaffe, the director of The Killing Fields, The Mission, and City of Joy, a new film set in the slums of Calcutta. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.